If you found the room, you are definitely investigative reporting. It took me a long time to get here. We should have Twilight music, Twilight Zone music in the background, and Rod Serling. When I say you have wandered into a document state of mind, that's the panel you're in. This is a redux of a panel that had some popularity several years ago, for several years running, actually. Mm-hmm. And Mark Horvat decided to bring it back for the 40-year anniversary of IRE. Thank you, Mark. With me today are Joe Stevens, on leave from the Washington Post while he teaches at Princeton and tries to motivate young, successful students to get into what we do.
And also, I'm going to be passing out tip sheets.
Tip sheets, too. And to his right, everyone knows Jim Steele, who just got the Founders Award at our banquet. Jim is a legend. Jim did some of the first real investigative reporting and some of the first real computer-assisted reporting when he was in Philadelphia with the court system. Plus, he's very generous with his knowledge. A colleague kind of helped me understand the popularity of this panel a couple of years ago when he said, you know, it's a little like going to church. It's not about learning a lot of new stuff every Sunday. It's more about being reminded of things we need to know and reminded that there's great documents out there to get. So welcome, all ye faithful, to a document state of mind. We'll be grateful if you leave here with your own document dogma. And there's a handout. Joe has a handout with our five canons for using documents and a list of some of our favorite documents, which we'll be mentioning also. And we hope to leave plenty of time for questions at the end and for you to tell us what your favorite documents are, because we love to share documents. We're all document hounds, and we always have been. We'll beg for them. We'll borrow them. We'll FOI them. We'll Google them. And the word document comes from the Latin root. It means a written or printed paper, a recording, a photograph, or a computer-generated application that bears the original, official, or legal form of something and can be used to furnish, and I boldface these, decisive evidence or information. Synonyms include warrant, writ, corroborate, and proof. I love documents. I love bankruptcy cases and property records. I love letters and audits and minutes of meetings. Personal financial disclosure statements and all the raw documents that back them up. Lists and lists of lists. I love Excel spreadsheets, even though I'm not as good at Excel as I wish I was. They say dead men tell no tales, but documents about dead men do tell tales. And I love to FOI FBI documents or FBI files on politicians in my area who've recently died, and you can get them. Just send a copy of the obituary with your request. I love to troll docket sheets in Pacer and my county's website, and I especially love court documents. I've spent many, many happy hours worshiping at that altar. I love FDA inspection records, my county's online real estate tax collection data, visitor sign-in registers, 990 tax returns. That's one of my favorites. But look at them over several years, not just one year at a time. Certificates of value, deeds, annual corporate reports, 10-Ks, 8-Ks. I love USDA sanitation reports for meat plants. And I especially love them now that you can search them. So the first search term I put in when I get a sanitation report on a meat plant is fecal. And I get a lot of hits on that, unfortunately. I love credit headers. And I don't know if you read it or heard it, but Marty Behrens of the Post gave a great talk out in California in April where he talked about the new media and all the changes we're going through. And here's something he said. The best journalism involves discovery. It involves surprise and wonder and excitement and knowledge. And that's what documents give us. And that's why we love documents so much. I urge you to read that speech by Marty. It's really well done. There was a piece in the IRE Journal this week that I read on the plane on the way out, and it quotes the late Jack Nelson. Jack's favorite question in an interview was, and this is quoted in IRE Journal, "No shit. You don't expect me to believe that." And the answer he always got was, "Of course I expect you to believe it. I've got a document that proves it, and it's right here in my desk." And that's why we like to carry thumb drives with us to interviews. Just download that document for me. We dig through mounds of useless files to find that perfect document. I once went through 7 boxes of court files, and what I wanted was in the last folder of the last box. But it was well worth it. We'll read them upside down and backwards. And that's not to say that interviewing people isn't fun. We love to interview people. But going to those interviews, having consumed all of the documents that you find useful, can give you a real leg up in an interview. Some people get off on cocaine and peyote. We get off on documents. And we have these spectacular document moments. We've all had them. Many of you have probably had them. It's a kind of a heart-pounding rapture when you find just the right document you've been looking for. It's a revelation that comes when you find that key document that puts everything in perspective or helps you put the puzzle back together. I often like to think of what we do as putting a puzzle back together. Journalists are taught that if your mama says she loves you, check it out. We say, if your mama says she loves you, have her put it in writing. I love financial statements. If it's stamped confidential, my heart skips a beat. I love civil suits and criminal suits. And when the big puffy envelope full of documents, and this was true before documents came on CD-ROMs, when that big puffy envelope comes into my mailbox, I can't wait to get to my desk and rip it open and have the insulation fly everywhere. Then I carefully arrange them on my desk, searching for just the right document, feng shui. I love the OSHA database and OSHA inspection reports. I love Department of Labor 5500 pension reports. It tells you a lot about pension plans. Not as much as we like, but a lot. They're a window in our government and how it really works, and how and why our society fails its most vulnerable people. I love documents because they give me wonderful quotes. I once did a piece on a visa system in which employers had to prove that they couldn't find U.S. workers to fill a job, so they had to hire foreign workers. And these folks were starting a large factory pig operation in Michigan. And at a time when many American pig farmers were out of business and going out of business, they hired French pig farmers. And I have a document. Of course, I've lost it, so I can't prove it to you. But I had a document that actually said that the employer claimed that pigs produce more often when spoken to in the language of love, which is why they had to hire a French pig. I love building permits, congressional hearings, IG reports. There are lots of documents that are out there that you wouldn't think even exist. The Labor Department actually requires union officials to file a document admitting if they've ever taken a bribe from an employer to sell their members down the river. One of those documents was actually filed once in Kansas City, and I was able to show that a union leader took a set of tires from an employer to sell his members down the river. There's great ways to get names of documents that you need, and one of the things I love to do is when I read an Inspector General report, I always read the footnotes too. The footnotes often refer to government documents that are used by the IG in gathering the information he needed for his audit. And I found, through that method, a document that the U.S. Marshals Service actually requires guards to fill out, which says if they have abused deportees during a deportation flight. They're great documents, and I had a lot of them to look at. And I remember when I FOI'd the document, the Marshals Service called me back and said, "Nobody's ever asked for this before." And I think it's because nobody knew it existed. I love GAO reports and the documents compiled to write GAO reports. Congress exempts itself from every law they pass almost, including the FOI Act. And, of course, the GAO is a creature of Congress. But if you call the GAO and say, "I read your report, I loved it, but I want to see the basic documents, the raw documents you used to put it together, I know you're not covered by FOIA, but you know you should be, so I'd like to come in and look at them." I've had GAO officers actually tell me I can do that. I love stadium leases and patents, industry newsletters. I once read a newsletter called Turkey World for a whole year. Learned a lot about the meat industry. And I love to search for whistleblowers on a website called the Merit Systems Protection Board, where you can actually look for pissed off federal employees by agency. So, for example, after Katrina, you could have gone to that website and looked for angry employees of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which I think some people did. I love internal memos. I once got a document from the Department of Agriculture, which was a proposed tryout of a plan to tenderize meat. And what they were proposing to do was pump meat tenderizer into a cow after it had been slaughtered, after it had been killed. And they called it post-mortem infusion. They decided not to go forward with it, but I think it was kind of fascinating they'd even consider it. It helps you look, documents help you look behind the corporate veil. UCC documents, how many of you have ever used UCC documents, Uniform Commercial Code? Do you know that art gallery owners often file UCC statements? It's like used car dealers will get loans on the cars on their lot that they haven't sold, and they'll file a document saying, well, I got a 65 Falcon here and it's worth $2,000. Well, art dealers do the same thing. So you can compare what they think the value of their paintings are to what they actually sell them for. We learned a lot about a Santa Fe art dealer that way once. Not long ago, we had a horrible, tragic accident in Kansas City in which some company had started a party bus company. And young women who were on a bachelorette party going down the freeway, and they made a sharp turn, and one of the women fell out of the back of the back door of the party bus and was run over about five times, and she was dead immediately. We took the VIN number from that party bus, and I Googled it. That's all I did. I just Googled it. I got the original documents for when the company bought the party bus. It turned out it was an old handicap van that, you know, that was very old and not in good shape, and the back door had not been properly fastened. The back door had always had a problem with it, and that's what ended up killing this young woman. Just Googling the VIN number. A lot of young reporters often don't ask for documents, either because they don't think they can get them, or it's a hassle, or it takes too long. But I urge you to do that. I try to have FOI requests pending almost all the time. I've got a FOI request pending now for documents about railroad bridges. We have two railroad bridges crossing the Missouri River in Kansas City. And you know what the railroads are hauling now. They're hauling all kinds of oil. Both these bridges, each of them, are more than 100 years old. And the useful life of a bridge, according to documents I've seen at the Federal Railroad Administration, is something like 60 years. So I'm waiting for those documents. My heart's pounding as I wait for those documents. But don't not ask for documents because you don't think you can get them. And I'll end with my favorite document story. They've all heard it before, but I can't not tell it. I once was doing some work on some fake paintings, and one of the people in the provenance line, the ownership line of those paintings, actually worked for the state of Texas, for an agency in Texas. Texas has a good Open Records Act, so I called the agency and I said, would you send me everything in her file? And so there's a bored bureaucrat putting stuff in a fax machine, and of course I'm standing at our fax machine like this, waiting for the documents to come through. And the last document that came across was the woman's entire NCIC file. Five or six pages. Never should have been sent to me. So I take it back to my desk. My hands are trembling. I'm reading it. My phone rings, and it's the general counsel of this state agency in Texas. Mr. McGraw, we've just wrongly sent you a document you shouldn't have, the NCIC report for so-and-so. I said, I know, it's right here in my hand, I'm looking at it. And she said, well, you can't have that document. I demand that you immediately fax it back to me. And I did. And I still have it. So I love documents. I can't get enough of them. Even now I'm semi-retired, I still love documents, and I'm still working to get them. So, Deacon Joe, what do you think of documents?
I think we're going to have to update that anecdote to email it back. Just update it a little bit. I'm Joe Stevens. Hi. Like Mike, I find there's something just warm and fuzzy and reassuring about having file drawer after file drawer overflowing with paper files. And I suppose I've got lots of people out there who agree with us on that feeling. Although more and more, obviously, I have electronic documents. I have a true confession. At the Washington Post, they sold the building a while back, like a lot of newspapers, to help make ends meet before Jeff Bezos stepped in and made life wonderful for everyone there. But we have to vacate by the end of the year, and as part of that, the office manager, a wonderful, efficient woman named Melissa, decided to do a census of file drawers. And she came to my desk very sternly one day and said, "Joe, we've got to talk." "What's the matter?" She said, "Well, we counted every file drawer in the building, and you've got more than anyone else. So you have 60 file drawers." I'm like, "Oh, my goodness, what was I thinking?" And she said, "You got to whittle these down." So I was very contrite and thinking, I whittle these down. Melissa, it's okay. I'm so sorry. But in my head, I'm like high-fiving myself because she missed my files in the basement. I mean, can you guys sympathize? I bet you guys can sympathize with this. And if there's any posties out there, don't tell Melissa I just told that story. Please, please. Lawsuits, property records, audits, internal reports, internal memos, congressional testimony, email company letters. I have a deep and abiding affection for all of them. The fact is, documents, and most of us know this, but it's good to remind ourselves, right? They add power. They have an authority that the spoken word just doesn't have. And we all know this, but sometimes we forget in the flurry of chasing stories and deadlines that if someone tells you something, it might not be news, it might be inside the paper news, it's not going to be on front of the homepage news if it's not in a document. That can make all the difference in the world. Documents don't waffle, they don't spin, they don't change your story over time. An example of this would be years ago, I looked into Pfizer, the world's biggest drug company, and I was looking into what they did overseas. And I was actually able to find a document. I never would have imagined I could have found this document, which itemized specifically how they experimented with an unproven drug on children in sub-Saharan Africa in the middle of a record deadly epidemic. And the document spelled out exactly what they did to these children and how 11 died, and it went day by day, hour by hour, and described how these children died one by one. I would never have expected to find that document. Wrote a story on it, front page of the Washington Post. The CEO of Pfizer was charged with homicide. Now, if I had had a doctor who'd been at that medical camp at the time and told me that story, we may or may not have written a story on it. I'm convinced it wouldn't have been front page news. It would have not been highlighted in that way. But because we had a document, it was top of the front page, Washington Post, highlighted, the CEO charged with homicide. That's the power that a document adds. People can't argue with it. On another story, I was looking into the Nature Conservancy, the world's largest environmental group, and I found a document that I never would have expected, in which the Nature Conservancy wrote in great detail how they had been given a plot of land in Texas for a nature preserve so they could save the nature there, and they immediately decided to drill for oil. The document went on to describe how the most endangered bird species in North America lived on this nature preserve. They drilled directly under the nesting ground, and in the process, a number of endangered birds died. A Nature Conservancy operation. It was down on paper. As a result, there were congressional hearings or sweeping reforms. The Nature Conservancy initially said it didn't really happen that way, but we had their document. Where did I get the document? It was buried in a lawsuit in Galveston, Texas, unrelated dispute, and it was many files in. It took a couple days of reading through files, which were worthless to us, to find this file. Never would have expected it. One investigative hint, Always look at lawsuits, no matter what the dispute's about, because you never know what's hidden inside in discovery. That was a total shock, but it had impact because it was a document. Give you a more specific example. We just had a great lunch, right? Great lunch ceremony. But if Jim Steele, Founders Award winner, came up to you, as esteemed as he is, and said, you know, that award was great, but I don't know about that chicken we were eating. I don't know about the hygiene at this hotel. It's like, you wouldn't write a story on that, right? You would pay little attention, even though it's Jim. But what if you had a document? What if you had a bad enough attitude that before this conference, you actually went and checked the health inspection reports for the hotel? And you actually saw what the hygiene was in the kitchen. I happen to have one. And you know the restaurant downstairs, 13, the glitzy restaurant, where they've got a $26 pork chop and a $30 filet mignon? Well, back in the back where you can't see, on the countertops, apparently they have a little black mold problem. And there's black mold on the countertops where it comes in contact with the food they're serving. Maybe that $30 filet mignon. So the point here is not to gross you out. The point is, it's in a document. So maybe you pay a little more attention if I or Jim or Mike was telling you this. And because it was a really nice lunch, I'm not going to get into the other stuff. The slime on the soda guns, no. The pink-gray buildup on the dishwasher, no. And I'm really not going to get into the stagnant water in the kitchen because the drains are clogged and it caused a fruit fly infestation.
There's no reason to get
it. I'm not going to get into that, except for one point. That might not sound so bad, but if you go back 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years, they've had the same backed-up clogged drain, water stagnation, and the same fruit fly infestation for 4 years, which is another investigative tip. Don't look at a document for just 1 year. Go multiple years, and you can see trends, changes. And in this case, you can see a rather interesting lack of changes over 4 years. Now, our attorney said I should also say that the last inspection was in November, and I'm sure they've cleaned all these problems up by now. Enough of that. Mike mentioned the IRS Form 990 just to throw out some of my favorite documents. That's been one of my favorite documents over years. I can't tell you how many great stories I've gotten out of IRS Form 990s. These essentially are the tax returns that nonprofits file with the IRS, and they have a lot more information in there than what taxes they paid or didn't pay. But I was looking through a while back, and I thought I knew these things backwards and forwards, and I came across the line. I was at home at night reading these for fun, which is fun. In any other group, that would be a strange thing to say, but everyone gets it here, I'm sure. I'm reading this for fun. I come across the line I've never seen before, and it said, it was a question, did the organization become aware during the year of a significant diversion of the organization's assets? I'd never seen that in before. It's like, where's that come? Is this a new thing dropped in? So I went to Nexus first, and I stuck in significant diversion and found that the term had never been used in a news story in reference to an IRS form before. No one had ever reported on it, so now I'm really interested. So I do some more research, talk to some tax attorneys, and it turns out what that question is really asking is, did you or anyone you know in your charity rip off a crap load of money this year? That's exactly what it's asking. And the organization I was looking at had checked the yes box. So that's pretty interesting. Ultimately, my colleague Mayor Pat Flaherty came in and helped me out. We put together a list of over 1,000 nonprofits and charities who had checked the box, who had lost huge amounts of money to internal fraud by their own board members and their own employees, and they had lost over $500 million totaled up. Some of these organizations had lost millions, some tens of millions of dollars, and they hadn't bothered to tell anybody about it, but it's down on the document, and that's one reason documents are a wonderful thing. And that's just one document to use. Despite all this, our favorite documents, and I think all three of us can go on for hours in the bar later about our favorite documents, but the actual truth is, your favorite document, you might never use it again. You might use it in a story. It's really powerful. You might never come across a use for it again. But the real power is to compare and contrast and triangulate the information in documents with other documents. And that's where the real investigative power comes to the top. And we've given these sessions for years, too many to count right now. But often people sort of get fired up. New reporters get fired up with documents in FOIA, the whole religion of FOIAs. And they'll go and they will FOIA something and they'll get a big box on their desk and they're all excited and they tear through it. And then they end up, well, there's no smoking gun in here. There's nothing on its own which generates a story. And they get jaded and just move on and go back to reporting interviews and meetings. But the key is you compare and contrast. And one example of this, it was a colleague of mine years ago asked for every personal financial disclosure report that federal judges had filed in the area and got these back. And they were interesting to see how rich the judges were and what they owned and what property they owned. But a story didn't result. And then many years later, I was bored. I didn't have anything going on. So I asked for the same thing again, all the financial disclosure reports for the federal judges. But I didn't stop at just looking at the documents. I started, went into what I call my crunching phase, and I compared it to stories in Nexus. I'd Google terms in the documents. I'd look at SEC reports. I'd look at anything and everything I could find to compare and contrast without a real strategy, a real pattern, because that's, if it's something you're looking for, it might be interesting, might be news, but if you bump into something you're not looking for, that's really news, right? And so just one of the things I did was I took the list of the judges and their stock holdings, and I went down to the federal courthouse, and I started plugging the names of the stocks, the companies, into the court computers. And the very first company I plugged in was AT&T, and I got a list of lawsuits against AT&T in the federal courts. And then on the right side, I noticed there was the name of the judge. It's like, oh, that's interesting. And it turned out he was the judge presiding over these lawsuits. So what, in effect, you had, I had to think about this for a minute, you had someone suing AT&T, and one of the owners of AT&T threw the lawsuit out of court as unfounded. And that struck me as interesting. I didn't know what it meant. I had to look it up. It actually took a while because no one had really looked at this issue, but it's illegal. If you have a direct financial interest in the outcome of a lawsuit, you cannot preside over it as a judge, plain as day. Ultimately found over 100 cases involving dozens of judges where they had thrown out lawsuits in which they, in effect, were a party. That's illegal. It was a good story. But it came not just out of the personal financial disclosure reports. It was because I compared it to something else. And what you find is often you can take incredibly boring information and do it, layer it, and sometimes even put it in a spreadsheet. And you put four or five levels of these really boring documents and the information in them together, and you triangulate them, and you come up with amazing meanings that jump to the top. I don't want to go on too long, but just to give you some quick things, I started a list years ago of good documents to get kind of baseline, just where you start to get things going. And they've always been on my list because they helped us when I was working with Mike at the Kansas City Star. The Speaker of the House, most powerful politician in the state, went to prison as a result of some of these documents we got, which on their own sound kind of boring. Things we got were cell phone records. You can FOIA those. Sometimes they actually list the calls made and incoming calls on them, so you can put together a network of associates or cronies, depending on how negative you want to be. You can get the desk appointment calendars, either the paper calendar or the electronic calendar, shows where a public official is traveling, who they're meeting with. You can get credit card receipts. Sometimes there's specifically a gas credit card to fill up the city car or the state car. That shows where they're physically at, which compared with other documents can be revelatory. Federal Express billing records. You can see who their public official is overnighting things to. Personal financial disclosure reports, lobbyist expense reports. Another fun little one is if your state has a state airplane or even your city has an airplane, get the flight manifest. Every time a plane flies, in case it crashes, so they know who died, it's got the list of everyone on that plane. Once again, in our case, we could see that casino lobbyists were getting on the plane with state officials, something we wouldn't have known otherwise. So you can pile these up and come up with great stuff. You mentioned always carrying a thumb drive. You know, I know someone left a thumb drive on this platform up here. Why don't you check that out? Anyway, I'm going to stop going on and let you get to the main attraction here, Jim Steele.
I bet you're all wondering what I am, as to whether or not Joe should have shared that inspection report before lunch or after lunch. Like it. A number of years ago, is this working okay? You hear me okay? Some years back, when I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer, a story appeared in the paper one morning about a big debate on the main line of Philadelphia. A rhythm and blues singer had bought this big tract of land that went way back in history, 150 years, and he wanted to divide it up. And the reporter did a very nice story about how what was there, the kinds of plantings, how long it had been there, how that part of the county had changed over time. And he also talked about the house, how the house had additions, on and on, just very nice detail and so forth. And in this story was a paragraph that talked about how the owners had changed. And it went through about three owners. And one owner, it talked about how he kept an ancient car, a Pierce Arrow sedan, in the garage. Another owner had Louis XIV furniture. And yet another owner had gold and silver fixtures in the bathroom, cigarette cases. And the pièce de résistance was in one of these bathrooms. There was overstuffed fish above the basin. Now, the point of this story is the heart of all great writing is detail, specifics. I don't care whether you're doing investigative, feature, you name it, fiction, detail rings true with people. That makes something believable. Well, one of us looked at this story, and we were really struck by that particular paragraph. Like, where do you get that kind of detail about cars that old, stuffed fish over the bar? Do you go up into the clips of the library and you go through stories about this mansion over many years? Do you find somebody who's 95 years old who worked there throughout this whole time? I mean, this covered about 100 years. So one of us at one point asked the reporter on this where he got it. And you know what he did? He went to the courthouse in the county where that house was located. He had the names of three or four of the previous owners, pulled the probate court records of each one of those people. And all of these people had money. So in the case of each estate, there was an inventory of what was in the house and the various assets of people, including that wonderful remark about the overstuffed fish over the bar. Nothing illustrates to me anymore the concept of a document state of mind than that particular story. Because here's somebody thinking, well, where do I get the richness? Where do I get the detail to really explain, you know, what's all about this story? And there it was. It had to occur to him to do that. It wouldn't just naturally occur to you. And so that's what, when we talk about a document state of mind, because Don Bartlett and I have used documents for many years, and people think that's all we do is look at documents. They think, we know where everything is because you've done all these things. You know, but the fact of the matter is you don't know where things are unless you are doing the same story over and over again. And almost 95% of the time, you're not doing the same story over and over again. You're doing something new, and you have to figure out where you find that particular information. I can give you many examples on that, but one in particular, we did a huge series a few years ago when we were at Time Magazine on Native American gambling. And one of the issues in it was some of the very rich tribes that had become quite wealthy from gambling were also apparently pulling in more money from the federal government on a per capita basis than the poor tribes, the ones up in South Dakota, the Dakotas, and certainly the ones down in the Southwest that didn't have casinos. So we wanted to find out, how do you find out what the government has? So the tribes certainly wouldn't provide that information. The Bureau of Indian Affairs wouldn't provide it. One day, by sheer accident, we run across something called Single Audit Database, Audits of States, Local Governments, and Nonprofit Organizations. And in that, it listed the specific amount of money that each one of these tribes was receiving from various agencies. It went under the bloated term of OMB, 348-0057. For all I know, that form doesn't even exist that way, but I suspect it does. But the point being, we used it for that series, we used it for that story, never used it since. And that's the way you really need to think of documents. There are some we'll use over and over again, of course, deeds, mortgages, divorce records, a whole raft of court papers. But some of the things that provide the greatest detail, like some of the ones that both Joe and Mike talked about, those you use one time and never use them again. A couple years ago, we did a piece on the airlift of cash from the U.S. to Iraq at the beginning of the Iraqi war, because we airlifted $12 billion shrink-wrapped in pallets like they were children's toys, shipped it to Iraq as walking around money because we didn't want Saddam Hussein's picture on the currency. And most of that money disappeared, and we did a piece, a whole story on this for Vanity Fair. But one of the most interesting side bits of the story was when we did the Freedom of Information Act, and the government provided us with the contract related to that project. It was about the company that was supposed to look out for the money, to watch to see how this $12 billion was dispersed, where it went. This company, we found out by looking in California records and in San Diego records, and you won't believe this. This is really your government at work. This company that got a $1.4 million contract to keep track of $12 billion, you know what their prior experience had been in San Diego County as far as we could figure out? Putting in rec rooms and additional bathrooms in houses, suburban houses in San Diego. There was no accounting component at all with this company as far as we could tell. All that traced through records both at the corporate level in San Diego and also in Sacramento. But one of the most interesting things about this, and both Joe and Mike talked about this, in the FOI request that did come through, while they did redact almost all the information, they left the mailing address of this company that was to watch over this stuff. And it was a post office box in Nassau. So I don't know what possessed us to do this, but we just Googled the post office box. It's one of the wonderful things we can do nowadays that you just couldn't do a few years ago. Well, up pops this very obscure document from a bankruptcy court somewhere in Florida. And I won't tell you the whole trail of this, but the point being, it led to the Bahamas, and that particular post office box was the center of a multi-hundreds of millions of dollars offshore tax scam that we were able to link to this contractor, who was the Pentagon contractor. But again, it's thinking to do something. It doesn't naturally come to mind when you get an FOI request like that to necessarily Google every little tidbit of information. But just as a lark, we plugged in the post office box, and it led to this huge revelation of the contractor's involvement in this whole offshore situation. So that's why, in my mind, in some ways we live in a great golden age of documents, because we can do all of these things now. I mean, technically that bankruptcy filing was always there, but how are you going to find it? You're going to go through 100 bankruptcy courts to find it? It's impossible. It's the wonder of these search engines that let you do these kinds of things today. So never forget that, and always keep that in mind. We used to refer years ago to a document state of mind, that somewhere there will be a document that will prove what you want to do until you're proven wrong. This is now morphed into what we call a web state of mind, because so many of the documents are now not really physical, but they're on the web. But apply that same thinking, that same process to it. That's changed. The web has been a marvelous opening thing for all of us to do that. But one thing hasn't changed about documents, and I think this is something to always remember, and it's a mistake an awful lot of young reporters make. When you start looking at something, you want this blockbuster document. You want this kind of thing where somebody's making a movie of you, and the camera's zeroing in like that, and it just blows the lid off the thing. You say, wow, look at that. Well, I'm still looking for those documents after all of these years. The fact of the matter is, most documents, it's a piece of a puzzle. One of you referred to the puzzle, and that's the way this stuff works. No one piece is always particularly significant, but it's each one that you put together and then you get that picture. And that's always the thing to remember. So sometimes when you get something, it may be very important, but you don't know it at the time. Some years ago, we did a big project on the tax reform act, which was, by the way, you know, there are all these movies about how exciting investigative reporting is. Well, look, it's a lot of basic drudgery that any of us will attest to, and reading the tax code kind of falls into that category. Anyway, we're looking at this, reading the actual tax reform act, and on something like page 548, there's a section that repeals these horrendous tax shelters down in the Virgin Islands. And Congress is like, you know, patting itself on its chest. Look what we've done. Right after that says exception. And the exception says, paragraph B, D above, blah, 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 shall not apply to a company incorporated in Delaware on or about March 3rd, 1981. Talk about specifics. And owns one or more office buildings in St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands. I mean, I was almost asleep when I came across that category, that phrase. Turned out it was a very rich California developer who'd gotten his local congressman to slip that in, the idea being to save him many millions of dollars. The Tax Reform Act was loaded with these, which we proceeded to decipher. I got to digress on one thing. There's a lot of talk about entrepreneurship and journalism nowadays. I mean, we all know that term. You see references with all the things we can do. Bartlett and I missed one of the greatest opportunities for entrepreneurship in our lives with this story. Because do you know that the sleep aid industry is a $30 billion a year industry in this company? We had in our hands one of the greatest sleep aids of all, the U.S. tax code. I mean, think about this in a drugstore, you know, tax code PM, non-toxic, non-habit-forming, always works. One of those missed opportunities that you all go through in this world. We're running a little short on time here, so I just want to truncate a couple things. We'd like to hear your questions. Just a couple things. Documents have really revolutionized reporting in this country. When I began in the business, you wanted to find out something, you reach for the phone, you call somebody. It didn't really occur to a lot of people that there was another way out there that had the color, that had the detail, that had ways to get accuracy in things. Such as Mike and Joe talked about. Eventually, that did occur to me. And that has also been part of the whole evolution of journalism. We've always had great writers, narrative writers, who could turn a phrase. We still have them. But to that great skill is now added, with many of these same writers, data, documents, all of which put together an amazing story. You know, it's one thing to write a story about maybe a baby who dies because the blood test wasn't performed properly about their genetic disorders. It's another thing to do what Ellen Gabler did in Milwaukee, to be curious about that one particular case and wonder how much of this goes on around the country, and then to write every state in the union and get the data from those states, 38 of them all, 12 of them wouldn't comply, and put together to show that that little baby that died there in that Milwaukee hospital, that wasn't an exception. A lot of this goes on everywhere. And in fact, only two states properly send the blood out in a timely fashion to see if there are these genetic disorders. This is one of the great changes in reporting. It's not just the great anecdotal story, which is very powerful, but these things are very often then related to something much greater and more significant, and very often lead to systemic changes. Two more things. Never assume where you're going to find something either. The first rule I learned in journalism was on a very simple level. Never assume how somebody's name is spelled. Never assume that because they work for the Butler Steel Manufacturing Company that they necessarily are manufacturing steel. I mean, ask those dumb questions. You know, get it nailed down, be specific. I've learned that lesson my first week in journalism. I learn it every week I'm a journalist because you never know where you find things. And I'll leave you just with one story on this. A number of years ago, Bartlett and I were doing a big project on the international oil crisis. And there were all kinds of problems. There were gas lines in the U.S., and we come up with some information that suggested it really wasn't this much of a crisis. There was a lot of oil around. And one of the places I went to was Genoa, Italy, which is the leading oil in Italy. And a friend of mine who spoke Italian, I said, let's just go down there and see if they got any data on this. He said, look, we'll do it, but you know, the Italians are not like the U.S. They're not up to date on this stuff. So we went down, found this wonderful 12th century bank building, Banco San Giorgio. Kept asking around, does anybody keep this data on Euro? Genoa was the biggest port in Italy, so that would be a test if people were cut back, right, during the cutback. Finally find this guy in the bottom of the basement of this place, Antonio Orlando. He had never, as far as we know, ever seen a journalist in his entire life. And my friend through Italian asked him, do you have any data, like, you know, on your oil? So Antonio was beside himself, runs to his file cabinet, you know, eyes flashing, wow, somebody wants my numbers. So he pulls these out and gives them to me. I said, ask him if he's got the, you know, those 3 years at the same period last year. Runs back to the file cabinet even faster than the first time, pulls them out, brings them out. I'm looking at him. I say, wait a minute, I'm thinking to myself, there's no cutback here. I said, ask him all of this year, all of last year, all the year before that. Antonio is absolutely beside himself now. Nobody has ever wanted to see his numbers, and he wants to share these with us. So they come out, we look at him, and I can look right away. You don't even need a calculator to tell. During this time, supposedly oil was cut back. It wasn't cut back. More oil than ever was coming in. So I asked him the story. I said, ask Antonio what's going on here. There's supposed to be an oil cutback. So we ask him that in Italian. Antonio starts laughing, almost hysterically. He said, you know, there's no shortage. It's just something manipulated by the oil companies, all to jack up prices, which turned out to be, in fact, the case. So never assume where you're going to find something. Never assume who will talk to you. Never assume you know fully what a story is about. Keep digging to the very end. Anyway, we started a little late, and I guess we have to get out of here in about 10 minutes. So if anybody has any questions, we're all here to answer them.
Hi. I had a question about non-public documents as distinct from documents that might come from official or government sources, like the health inspection report you talked about, Joe, earlier, in which you can rely on with a reasonable degree of confidence because it comes from an official source. Whereas the kind of documents that might arrive in your mailbox in a, you know, secret envelope or a source gives to you and they relate to internal records of a company, for instance, how do you treat those types of documents differently to official public documents? Specifically, I wanted to ask about that Pfizer document you talked about earlier, in which, if I heard correctly, you published a story which resulted in homicide charges leveled against the CEO. Did you, because it was, I think, an internal record, did you have to take extra steps to authenticate and corroborate it before you had the confidence to publish?
Yeah, the records in this case were the actual clinical trial data from the field in this clinical trial that Pfizer had done. And I can't tell you exactly how we got a hold of this. It was through unofficial means. And they were so complete and so voluminous and so detailed, it would have been quite an accomplishment to have falsified those. Nonetheless, yes, you worry when you don't get something through official means. We didn't get it from the FDA. They thought it was confidential. In that case, what I did was I spent months studying up on Quinolone antibiotics, so I became a minor expert in it and could figure out what was going on, and it all seemed to jive. And then what I did, and I won't go into the whole story, but I got on a plane for Kano, Nigeria, without talking to anyone in Nigeria before I went. And I just showed up in this tiny, dusty little, that built itself as a hospital. It wasn't much of a hospital. I knocked on the door. I didn't know if the Nigerian physician whose name was on as the primary investigator was even still alive, still lived there. I found the office. I knocked on the door. He opened the door. And I said, hi, I'm from Washington. Can I come in? Amazingly, because I think he was stunned to see someone from Washington, he opened the door, went in. We had a nice little chat. Halfway through the chat, I opened my briefcase, and I pulled out the story of little 0069. We did not have this girl's name, this little girl who's given the experimental drug and died over 3 days. And I handed it to him and said, could you look at this for me? And he looked at it for the longest time. And then finally he looked up and he said, I remember this girl very well. Why we didn't take her off the experimental drug, I have no answer for you. And at that moment I figured my documents were accurate.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. sorry if this question is too basic for all the pros in the room, but I'm just starting out trying to cover Congress. And there's no FOIA laws, we all know, for Congress. So, and you had mentioned public calendars or calendars for public officials and credit card usages. I just want to know, like, who I would ask for that and if there's a place where I can find all of the things that Congress has to give you.
As Mike mentioned, Congress exempts itself from most of the laws it passes. So you have no legal right to anything, and someone jump in and correct me, no legal right to anything in a congressman's office. Now, you can ask. There's no reason you can't ask, and you can't make it public that they're not letting you know. And, of course, Congress puts out a lot about their public appearances, which is often on their website and often archived. If it's not, it's probably on the Wayback Machine. If you guys haven't used a Wayback Machine, it's a fantastic thing. But unfortunately, unlike the lowest county board member, you don't have a legal right to your congressman's appointment calendars.
This wouldn't help you in that. But every representative and every senator has to file a disclosure statement, and it does have some financial detail in it in terms of what their net worth is and holdings. It's within a range. It's not a specific thing. That doesn't have the calendars on it, but it does have some other indication of what some of their other activities are and what they do and where they go and so forth. So that's online. That's another one of those things that you used to have to go to this little cubbyhole in the Senate or in the House and ask for those. But that's another great thing that's out there now that is available to you if you have access to the Internet, of course.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also, while he's talking, I remember, they also have to, in Congress, they have to itemize all their expenses. And so you can see the airline tickets they purchase, which isn't exactly an appointment calendar, but you can see the airline tickets or if they're reimbursed for mileage driving to and from their district or whatever. And that might help you out some. That's, what is it called, the disbursements of the House for members of Congress. And the Senate has a similar one. Accounting of the Secretary of the Senate, something like that. Those can be really helpful. They're difficult to read, but they can be really helpful. They have all the spending.
If I could do one aside, years ago when Dan Rostenkowski was the congressman from Illinois in Chicago and the head of the House Ways and Means Committee, arguably the most powerful guy in the House, he had a typeset in his office that was a direct descendant of Egyptian hieroglyphics. And you could barely read the disclosure statements unless you blew them up but anyway, they filed them anyway. Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I keep on going. My name is Laura Gunderson. I'm with the Oregonian, and I would just love to hear how you track your FOIA requests, keeping on top of the responses.
Let's see.
You, Mr. FOIA? My record on a FOIA request is 8 years, and it's been said before in a panel where Walt Bogdanovich was talking the other day, he gave some great pointers about how to keep your FOIA active, be overt about it. Don't just send your letter and wait. But I would get to know my FOIA officer. I'd call him every Tuesday at 4 o'clock. Hi, Dick, how you doing? Where's my stuff? And I would also look for other people that would have reason to have the same thing. And in my 8-year case, I found that another organization had gotten it. I called them that day, and I said, look, I've been waiting 8 years. You just gave it to them yesterday. I want it now. And I had it that day. Get to know your FOIA officer. Join ASAP, which is American Society of Access Professionals. It's the club for federal FOIA officers. I went to their convention once. But they give you this neat membership book that gives you the direct numbers. So join ASAP. It's like $25.
I don't think any area is there a greater variation in the response of officialdom than in FOIAs. I mean, I've run into reporters who never gotten an answer. And then you run into some where an agency is very responsive. But then that same agency 3 years later is not responsive. One quick story I had was I was trying to get some stuff years ago from the Department of Interior. I didn't file a FOIA. I knew the press guy pretty well. He seemed to be pretty cooperative. And I asked him, I said, look, this is what I'd like. And he said, I'll get it for you. Time goes by. I call him again, doesn't get it. Finally, I call him and said, do you want me to file a FOIA? He said, oh, my God, no. Please.
don't file a FOIA. And I thought, what's this about? And I said, would this cause you problems? He said, oh, you can't believe. And I said, well, what is it? Does it besmirch the agency? He said, no, he said, the FOIA officer is crazy. It'd make my life so miserable. I mean, sometimes we look for conspiracies, and it's this little human thing going on with them. So you never, but always try. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's just one of those doors you open, and sometimes it works.
Hello, my name is Mel. I cover education for the Naples Daily News. The cost of documents, I think, is often a hindrance for journalists, especially ones from smaller news outlets. Can you share with some of your personal anecdotes or tips for overcoming that, except for forking the money, obviously?
Do you have one in particular that was costly that you could give us?
Sure. I've requested discipline data from the state, and for 2 years' worth, it's going to cost me $1,200.
What state is this?
It's kids who have been disciplined in schools. Oh, Florida. Florida State.
What we have tried sometimes is we just said this is in the public interest, and to try to, you know, compel them or embarrass them or whatever to provide it. And the other thing, which you probably already thought of, is there's some other group out there that may have some of that documentation. The courts remain the greatest source of a lot of information all of us in the investigative field use, court files. And some of those can be expensive. But very often you can find somebody who's filed the lawsuit in that case who has the files, who's very happy to share them with you because they'd like it to be publicized. That's a recourse sometime. The other thing we do, if somebody wants to charge you a lot, we also say, would you send us one example of this, of what we're getting? And don't, because that's a real pitfall. Once the State Department was going to charge us $6,000 from some foreign military sales licenses, and this is back when $6,000 was a lot more money than today, and we said, send us one of these so we can look at it. Well, it looked like that thing we saw in the luncheon. Everything was redacted but the name of the company. And we realized that the bill was for the ink, not to process the reports. Anyway, so, do you have a...
most of you guys started with paper, I did too, and in organizing things. And I was just wondering, once you get all these documents and putting them together for a story, and now that's mostly online, computer, and do you revert back to paper, your old ways, or is it easier with computer? I get a little overwhelmed with computer and print a bunch of stuff out. How you organize things is basically what I'm trying to say.
I don't know if I have a good answer, but I tell myself I scan and OCR everything, optical character recognition, so you can search for it. That's not exactly true, but I try like heck to scan as much as I can in. And then just because I'm a hoarder, I keep the paper copy, too.
Maybe one more question. We started a little late because it was after lunch, and I think the next panel needs to come in here in about 5 minutes. So maybe one more quick question. Or I'm sorry.
Yeah, Kurt Devine with CNN. I'm just curious. I think we would all agree that it's better to be as specific as you can in a FOIA request with what you're looking for. But I'm just curious if you make it regular practice to, quote-unquote, fish and cast a wide net, or do you view that as a waste of time?
Oh. I do both. If I know exactly what I want, I go for it. But yeah. Sometimes I'll send such a broad FOIA request that the FOIA office will call, and they're tearing their hair out, and they're saying, look, this will take forever. It will cost you a mint. You'll never get all – well, okay, what do you have? And we start a conversation that way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this very often, what a lot of government agencies want to stop us at state and local level is they want us to be specific about what we want. Very often we can't be specific, and that becomes a device to deny something. So we just try to phrase things in a general way about reports dealing with blah, 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 if we don't have the specific name and so forth. And I think that's totally fair.
Thanks for coming. We need to close out, but it's...